209-2950 is the number to call to show your financial support to this institution. 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. Do whatever you can. We'll be extremely grateful for your efforts. Now stay tuned for Off the Hook. Coming up, it is 7 p.m., and this is WBAI New York.
Telephone company facility trouble in the area you are calling. Your call cannot be completed at this time. Please try your call later. 078P.
We're sorry. The number you have reached, 99.5 WBAI, is now off the hook.
A very good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Over here.
And over in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have our very special guest for tonight, Space Rogue. Welcome. And Space Rogue, I think you're muted. Hang on, I think maybe we muted you.
Somebody muted me.
Okay.
Might have been me. I don't know. I'm unmuted now. Thank you for having me here. Glad to be here.
Unmuted, unshackled. That's the way we like it. So before we get started tonight, I just wanted to reassure some listeners because we've been getting a lot of panicky emails and some phone calls of one visit. And people really seem to be thinking this is it. This is the end of civilization. And you know what? It might be. It might very well be. But it's not because of ChatGPT. So let's calm down. Now, what I did right before the show, I had a little conference with ChatGPT, and I asked a question, how can I tell the difference between a human and a chatbot? And this is what the source says. So please listen. It can sometimes be difficult to tell the difference between a human and a chatbot, especially if the chatbot is programmed to simulate human-like conversation. However, there are a few things you can look for to help you distinguish between the two. Response time. Chatbots typically respond much faster than humans, as they are able to process and generate responses instantly. If you receive a response almost immediately after sending a message, it's likely you're talking to a chatbot. Whereas if it takes a day for somebody to get back to you, yeah, pretty sure that's a human. All right. Consistency. Chatbots tend to be consistent in their responses, both in terms of the tone and language they use as well as the information they provide. Humans, on the other hand, may vary in their responses depending on factors such as mood, context, and personal experience. That's kind of like a diss, isn't it? Kind of saying that we're inconsistent, we don't really say the same thing all the time.
Yeah, the asymmetry, the imperfections, the nuance and long pauses.
So they're quick, they're consistent. Right. But we make up for it in complexity. While chatbots are getting increasingly sophisticated, they may still struggle with more complex conversations or responding to unexpected questions. If you're asking a question that requires a lot of context or knowledge and the response you get is overly simplistic or generic, it's possible you're talking to a chatbot. Emotion. While chatbots can be programmed to simulate emotion, they are not able to experience emotions in the same way that humans do. If you're having a conversation that involves strong emotions or personal experiences and the responses you're receiving feel detached or robotic, it's possible you're talking to a chatbot. Or one of us. I don't know.
Depends on the day.
That meets the definition of so many people I know. Ultimately, the best way to tell whether you're talking to a human or a chatbot is to ask them directly. Oh, yeah, right. That's going to work.
Are you a chatbot?
Humans don't tell the truth. Don't we know that by now? Many chatbots will identify themselves as such if asked, and humans will typically respond in a way that confirms their identity. I don't know about this this chatbot here. It doesn't seem very experienced with the ways of either chatbots or humans, but you know what? We just have to calm down. It's technology. It's a tool. It's something new. It's something fun to play with. And yes, eventually we will be buried by it, but that's down the road. Space Rogue, welcome and congratulations. You have a book out called Space Rogue, How the Hackers Known as Loft Changed the World. And you guys most definitely did change the world. Those of you who don't know, the Loft was one of the first ever hacker spaces in the Boston area. These guys pretty much were superstars of the time and still are to this day. Still making headlines in various manners. You testified in front of Congress in 1998. I'd like to sort of set the tone just by reading a brief excerpt from your book, which just came out.
Sure.
Fairly recently. This is all about something that every hacker knows a little bit about, and that's choosing a handle. You know, that rite of passage that we all go through. So this comes from the book. Shortly after I left Boston University in the spring of 1991 and was working as a rent-a-cop at the Lafayette Place Mall, I called up a new online bulletin board, or BBS, for the first time. I think it was simply called M. They requested that users create a unique username, something totally new that had not been used on any other system. The goal was to foster open communication without the baggage an existing identity would bring with it. I thought anonymity was an intriguing idea. No one would know who anyone else was, elite or lamer, old-timer or newbie. It wouldn't matter. Everyone on this new BBS would start out at the same level. I thought really hard about a new handle. Your handle became your identity. It was the only unique item you took with you online. Your handle was linked to your reputation, your hacking capabilities, and your previous exploits. It was essentially a full resume summed up in one word or phrase. BBSs were all text all the time. No graphics, no icons, or avatars to go along with your posts and musings. The only thing that set your messages apart from everyone else's was your username. Your status was based on what you wrote, and it was all attached to your handle. Early systems could only accommodate 8-character usernames, often not enough for a full first or last name, so people started to get creative, and handles became the norm. I wanted something cool for this new BBS. When the only thing separating your electronic bytes from someone else's bytes was your name or handle, that moniker takes on a greater significance. I started looking around my bedroom for inspiration, and I hit upon the book that I was reading, Cyberpunk: Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier by Katie Hafner and John Markoff. The book was over the top, full of exaggeration and inaccuracies, but still enthralling. While I didn't know it at the time, the book had a significant influence on me. I began freely associating with the title, especially the cyber part. Even at that point, I knew using any handle with the word cyber in it would not be a wise choice. In these early days of the internet, cyber was considered an almost dirty word. But cyber led me to cyberspace, so I started working with space instead, and somehow hit on Space Rogue. I spent maybe all of 10 minutes coming up with it. There was a new BBS that I wanted to get into. I didn't have time to stand around trying to pick the perfect handle. I just needed something new that was good enough for right now. I thought it would be a throwaway, one-time use. I would use it on this board, and that would be it. I had no idea. The Space Rogue would stick so well that I would still be using it nearly 30 years later. And with that, Space Rogue, an official welcome to the show. And how's the handle holding out?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I'm now, if you notice, like the book actually has my given name on the cover as opposed to just Space Rogue.
I wanted to ask, so, is it okay to use that? It's on the cover of the book, so I wanted to ask first, though. So,
well, thank you.
Welcome, Chris.
Not everybody does.
Chris Thomas. That's okay.
Yeah, Chris Thomas is the given name, and that is the author name of the book. So I've been using Space Rogue, you know, professionally for 30 years, basically, and have only recently started to use the given name in professional settings. It's hard to get paid as Space Rogue, which kind of, you know, you kind of can't go to the bank and show ID as Space Rogue to open a bank account anymore. Not that you ever could. But you know, if I wanted to get paid, I had to start using a given name. But even then, I still tried to use the handle all the time because that's what everybody knew me as. I didn't want to, I still wanted to take advantage of that historical nature of the handle. But when I came to the book, I was like, I thought about publishing it just as Space Rogue, but I also realized that was going to cause a few hurdles that I might have to jump over that I probably might not want to jump over.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the given name on the book as well.
Wow. And, of course, you're known as SR, too.
Yeah, so people call me SR, Space, Mr. Rogue, Rouge. Some people mispronounce it as Space Rouge.
Wow.
You know, think I'm all red or something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, I answer to most anything these days.
Wow. I think probably the thing that people are most aware of with the Loft in general. We'll talk about a bunch of your other projects as well. But
sure.
The thing that the Loft was known for was that testimony in that that spring day in 1998, I believe it was in May.
Yep.
And you guys went down to the Senate and you basically schooled them on security. And I don't know, do you think they listened back then?
Yes and no. I mean, it's taken a long time. I mean, here we are 25 years later. The 25th anniversary comes up this May, and it's been 25 years. And in some ways, not much has changed. In some ways, a lot has changed. I mean, I look at some of the initiatives taking place in government now, and I'm cautiously optimistic. CISA, the Computer Information Cyber Information Security Agency, I think is the appropriate title, is doing great things under Jen Easterly and is sort of making things be very aware, getting the word out there. Biden has a new cyber policy out, which seems to be making some waves as well. I mean, I think it's still early to say whether or not these initiatives are going to stick. We've seen a lot of different initiatives over the years, but hopefully these current ones are actually going to make some difference. And whether or not Loft had some influence on those current activities or not, you know, I like to think we did. But either way, it's good to see the progress.
Can you describe the setting when you guys went down there? How was it intimidating? I mean, I testified in front of Congress myself, but you guys had a much bigger platform. You were actually you had a full room. I had two senators, and neither one of them really knew much about what they were talking about.
Yeah, there's actually video of your testimony out there. I remember seeing it. I don't know where the link is now, but I did mention your testimony in the book because I think a lot of people think that Loft was first, and we were not. Like, you predated us, and then Susan Thunder actually predated you as having testified at Congress.
Uh-huh.
But the scene for us was we weren't really sure what to expect. We were aware of your previous testimony and that it wasn't probably the most positive experience. And we were kind of concerned, like, what was going to happen when we got in the room. I mean, once you're in the room, cameras are there, people are there, like, they can ask you whatever you want. So we didn't really advertise that we're going to Congress, you know, tune in on C-SPAN.
Mm-hmm.
We figured if it goes badly, we just won't tell anybody and we'll pretend it didn't happen. But thankfully, it was a more positive experience for us. But so we went down. We testified under our handles, which was a big thing for us because we wanted to make sure that we were trying to protect ourselves from lawsuits by using our handles. And somehow we convinced the Senate and the Congress that was okay.
That was the only time they allowed that for people that weren't in witness relocation.
So that's what we were told. In fact, you know, one of the ways that we knew that it was serious was that we had to get reimbursed for our travel expenses in cash. And to do that, we had to go down in the basement of the Capitol and talk to like this little guy in a closet who had all the petty cash for Congress and give them additional fake names. Because you can't, you know, put Space Rogue in the ledger as to who you paid off for his $23 in gas money or whatever it was. So we had additional fake names to sign the ledger with so we could actually get our cash.
Wait. What do you mean additional? You mean you made up names on the spot?
Yeah. Yeah. And so there was additional fake names.
They told you to do this or did they not know you were doing that?
No, they knew we were doing it ahead of time. They assigned us the names to use.
Do you remember the names? Actually.
They all started with the same first and last, the same letter of the first and last name, and they were baseball related. I don't remember exactly what they were. Kingpin knows, or used to know, but it was interesting. So we go down, we give our fake name, we give him our receipts, he'd total them up, put a ledger in the book, entry in the books, they signed here, we'd sign the fake name, he'd give us the cash. So that was interesting. That's kind of how we knew, like, okay, they were really serious about this whole handle thing, and we appreciated that because, like I said, you know, we were trying to protect ourselves from lawsuits from companies trying to sue us for releasing information about their security vulnerabilities.
You know, I want to hear the story of that guy in the basement. Somebody has to tell his story. That is incredible. Okay, so the testimony itself was that intense? I think it went on for what, about an hour or so?
Yeah, it was a little over an hour, a little under an hour. It was intense, and very stressful, at least for me. We got together ahead of time, and we had a written testimony that's published, in the Congressional Record, and then we had a verbal testimony, as well. We wrote out the written testimony, we wrote out the introductions, like the written testimony was like a week before, the introductions we did the night before in the hotel room. So we each had like a paragraph that we said as our introduction, and then we took questions from the senators. But it was really like for the first half an hour, I'm just sitting there like, I don't know what to say. And if you look, there's a famous picture of us testifying, like I'm looking down at the table in the picture, like, cause I can't even bring myself to look up in the room because it's, you know, it's a very stately room. The senators are up on a raised bench in front of you. There's oak or cherry paneling everywhere. Very, very intimidating to sit there. And it wasn't until like the second half of the testimony where I start to like, oh, I should probably say something. And I start to try to answer some of the questions. So if you watch the testimony, like I don't say much for the first half, and it's not until the second half where I'm able to get in a few answers.
Well, something was said, and we were up in New York. We were doing radio. I remember I think we did a show the day you guys testified, and we only heard rumors of that famous quote. The week after, it certainly hit all the newspapers. We have a clip. We actually have a clip from our show from May of 1998. Let's just listen to the initial reaction that we had.
All right. Speaking of government, boy, we talked about the loft thing for just a couple of minutes last week. You know that quote that everybody's been like quoting. What's that? I don't know if it's really a quote because I haven't seen it in context yet. We haven't been successful getting a hold of those people because I imagine they're in demand after things like that got out. Basically, the idea was that hackers could take down the entire internet in 30 minutes or less. That's right. A band of seven hackers from Boston told the Senate committee last Tuesday they could bring down the foundations of the internet in 30 minutes. And one of the people is Mudge, who was on our radio show a few months ago, actually. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, you're there in front of Congress. They can be kind of intimidating. And I guess, you know, things come out that maybe you don't want them to be interpreted in just that way. I can tell you right now, hackers are not going to take down the internet. I've been getting calls from reporters now for the past couple of days, ever since I got back, wanting responses to this threat that the loft poses to the internet. Of course, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that saying I can take down the internet in 30 minutes is going to be perceived as a threat by some dim-minded media people. But there are certainly security problems that could result in somebody with the proper access and access to a lot of different things and knowledge to achieve a desired effect. And the desire to do something bad. All that wrapped together And yeah, somebody could cause significant mayhem. And that's never really been an issue. Thing is it a threat from hackers? The answer is no. Hackers are not going to take down the internet in 30 minutes. So, no need to panic. But, definite need to increase security because there are all kinds of technical problems, all kinds of security issues that are definitely relevant. And things as stupid as you know, satellites that don't have any backup, same mentality goes into some aspects of the internet. And that's what you have to take into consideration, is that a failure in one way can lead to a failure somewhere else, and it just keeps multiplying until you have a complete breakdown of communication. That's what you have to watch out for. And that's, I think, what the people at the loft were trying to warn Congress about. Of course, you know, I've been there. I've been in front of Congress. I know that you say certain things, and it doesn't exactly get interpreted the way you want it to be interpreted. So I think we know what the interpretation was meant to be. The boneheads in the media, of course, will get it wrong every time.
All right, as an excerpt from 1998, reacting to the testimony of the loft, where, in fact, you guys did sort of say something like that. Mudge, I believe, was the one who said that. We have actually the exact excerpt we'll play in a moment. Was that a correct interpretation, that it wasn't intended to cause panic or to be interpreted as a threat from hackers?
Oh, absolutely not. No. Media did take it that way, and we have a collection of headlines. I think Kingpin still has a collection of headlines of, you know, hackers threaten internet, you know, blah, mayhem, et cetera. But the issue specifically had already been disclosed and had already been patched when it was announced during that testimony. Basically, it was an issue with BGP where it would cause a cascading failure of routers. And the only way to fix it would be to turn everything off and turn it back on again, like the entire internet, right?
Right.
But it had already been disclosed. A patch had already been issued. It wasn't really a major concern at the time we announced it, but it was a possibility.
I think we're going to play this excerpt from Mudge. I think he was maybe theorizing about other potential ways where this could actually still be a threat if certain things weren't taken seriously. And that's something I would even say to this day. If security is not taken seriously, then there will definitely be catastrophic occurrences. And that's not a threat. That's a fact. You know, you have to absolutely have decent security. And back then, it really was in its early days. Let's listen to the actual quote from Mudge.
I'm informed that you think that within 30 minutes the seven of you could make the internet unusable for the entire nation. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, one of us with just a few packets. We've told a few agencies about this. It's kind of funny because we think that this is something that the various government agencies should be actively going after. We know the Department of Defense just did a very large investigation into what's known as denial of service attacks against the infrastructure. In our various day jobs, we contributed a large portion of the information to that actual investigation. Much to our chagrin, the learnings from it were instantly classified, which we were giving them largely public information. It is very trivial with the old protocols to segregate and separate the different major long-haul providers, which would then be the national access points, the metropolitan area ether sections. AT&T can't talk to MCI, can't talk to PSINet, can't talk to Alternet, et cetera, et cetera, and keep it down that way as long as we really wanted to. It would definitely take a few days for people to figure out what was going on.
And that's from the congressional testimony of the loft back in 1998. I think that's pretty clear. That's pretty succinct as to what exactly was meant there. And if the newspapers and the politicians had been a little less hysterical, I think they would have learned a lot more quickly how to deal with the situation.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as you mentioned, I mean, we're still dealing with an internet and a network that is very fragile. We still have issues with BGP today. Where routing issues, take down large sections of the internet for short periods of time, thankfully, or major providers that just basically go offline because somebody pushed a button that was sent a configuration that was wrong. So, yeah, the whole internet is still built on bubblegum and baling twine.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. Well, we've been focusing on this one instance, this only one day in the world of the loft. Tell us, how did the loft begin in the first place?
So the loft arose out of a group of hackers in Boston who basically came together to store computer equipment in an old warehouse artist loft space in South Boston. The building still exists, but now it is high-priced condos. It's no longer the derelict factory warehouse building that it was. But we basically just stored our equipment there, and then eventually we started plugging it in. And then we bought a modem and got online and built a website, and the rest is history.
Well, is there a truth to the rumor that I've heard that somehow this is related to a hat business?
Yes. Yeah, so Count Zero and Brian Oblivion's wives were going to design hats, like the kind you wear on your head. They had half of this space that they – because it was a pretty decent-sized space. And so Brian and Count Zero had the other half. But even that was too much for Brian and Count Zero, so they invited White Knight, Golgo 13, a couple other folks to share this space with them while the wives did the hat business on the other side. Well, the hat business did not take off and failed within a couple of months, and so they still had – now they had all this more space, and that's when they invited myself and Kingpin and Weld Pond in to help share the rent, basically, and store some equipment in this space.
Wow. Yeah, I was reading some of the accounts, and I didn't realize some of you guys met at a 2600 meeting and then went to the loft afterwards for the first time to
see
it.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, 2600 was one of the communal gathering places. I think in Boston we had a bulletin board called The Works, and The Works had gatherings infrequently. They weren't scheduled. They'd happen every now and then. But then 2600 came along and put a little bit of structure into it. And so we'd have 2600 meetings in Harvard Square every month. First Friday of the month, have Aubon Pan. I'd go get my large iced coffee, Americano chocolate frothy drink thing, which I don't drink anymore. But I'd sit outside with the old men and the chess tables, and all the hackers would show up, and we'd kind of sit there and do a 2600 meeting. And then the weather would get cold, and we'd go to the pizza shop around the corner. Until they got realized that we weren't buying any pizza and kicked us out. And then we ended up at the Prudential Center in Boston, which I think is where the meetings still are. I'd have to check the listing.
The webpage, 2600.com/meetings, I don't know where they are myself. I do know they exist in Boston, but I'm not sure where exactly they are.
I think they're at the Prue, but they may have gone back to Harvard Square. I'm not sure either. But, yeah, check the website. But that was the ineptest of this, pretty much where we all met. Brian Oblivion ran a bulletin board called Black Crawling Systems, and he would only let people on the board who he had actually met in person. So there wasn't a lot of people on the board. But that's also where the loft came from membership from that board, which is from people he met at 2600 meetings.
Gila, the expression on your face tells me that you just found out where the meetings are.
I did, actually. Boston, the garage at Harvard Square in the food court area.
That's where we used to. That's where we got kicked out of 25 years ago.
And now the hackers are back for round two.
Indelible.
You know, what's amazing about that is I realize you guys were just kids back then and, looked upon with suspicion by the mainstream. But look what you went on to do. I just hope people are listening to this that are kids now that are going to meetings that are, just trying to fit in or figure out how technology works or how to manipulate things and realizing that, yeah, you can become amazing too. You can be writing books in a couple of decades and maybe even testifying in front of Congress in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, Kingpin was still in high school at the time when he joined the loft. I think I was in my early 30s. So we had a wide range of ages. So there isn't any one particular age that's good or bad that would like, oh, I'm too old, I'm too young, whatever. There's definitely any time you can jump in and get started.
You in your 30s then? You look like you're in your 30s now.
Yeah, I age slowly, I guess.
Some kind of time traveler. Okay, well, that's pretty amazing. Tell us about the book. Where did the idea for the book come from, and what did you hope to capture?
Well, I've been thinking about writing the book for a while. The story of the loft has kind of reached mythological status, I think, and it's sort of been retold. And I've heard different versions of some of the stories, and I'm like, that's not what I remember. Not to say that somebody else's version isn't accurate either, but I was there, and I remember things a little bit differently. So I felt it was important to record my version and write the story, but I had a problem, like, writing. Like, I'm not a writer, and so getting the stuff down was difficult. And I would start, and I would write a page, and I'd be like, oh, I can't do this. And I would write another page, and I'd be like, oh, this is terrible. And then, I don't know, somehow at some point something clicked, and I ended up doing an outline, and that's what did it for me. I did an outline. I was like, I want to do this story, I want to do that story, I want to put this story in, and I just listed the stories. And then I organized the stories, and then I filled in all the blanks. And when I was done, I was like, I got a book. And so I think I really wanted to just capture, some of the big important aspects of what loft did and what loft was, and some of the impact that we had, not just directly, but indirectly in the people that we influenced over the years.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. And you were able to find interest in publishing the book without too much of a challenge?
Yeah, yes and no. As I'm sure you know, publishing is a whole mess.
Yes, we are.
So basically, if you write a book or before you write a book, traditional publishing says you need an agent. Mm-hmm. To get an agent, you send out query letters, which is basically nowadays emails, and you format an email, you mail it off. And if you're lucky, you'll hear something back. Generally, you hear nothing. And that's normal for this industry. Like, it just goes into a black hole, and you don't hear nothing back. I sent out about maybe 200, 250 query letters to different agents. I probably heard back from maybe 75 of them. Like, the rest of them are just lost and gone forever. Of those 75, I had like four, I think, who were very interested in the story, wanted to do something with the idea. They're like, oh, this is really important. I want to publish this, but I want you to change all this stuff and do it different. I'm like, well, I've written a book. It's a memoir. I don't want to go and do a total nonfiction treatment. This is the book I wrote. This is the book I want to publish. And after like the fourth agent telling me that, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do it myself. But this took like 2 years to go through and, go through all these agents and these query letters and whatnot. And people think, oh, you self-publish it. It's real easy. You just upload it, click a button. Yeah, it's great if you just want to do Amazon and have a kind of a, crappy book. So I ended up having to hire editors and proofreaders and a book designer and get the cover done and all that sort of thing, which took months and months and months as well to do. And then I was able to upload it and push a button for Amazon. But I also wanted a hardcover because, it's not really a book to me unless you have a hardcover, which meant a whole other website called Ingram Spark, which you have to upload. And then you have to have an ebook on top of that because everybody buys ebooks. So, yeah, there's a lot involved in the actual publishing of the book yourself.
What kinds of things do they want you to change?
Well, mostly since it's a memoir, people didn't want it as a memoir. The idea was that memoirs don't sell. So they wanted a full regular nonfiction interview footnote treatment, very dry, very boring, very matter of fact type book. And I'm like,
that sells. that's what sells.
I'm like, that's not going to sell.
Like a historian would make?
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Like a more historical type. Academic and wow.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I know you're the expert and you probably know the market better than I do, but one, I ain't got time to write that. Like, that's a lot of work. And I have to interview at least 7 people, not to mention, everybody else. And I was like, the book is, 80% done. I just needed some help with the editing and stuff. And like, oh, no, we got to change all this and do that. And I'm like, yeah, no, thanks. I'll just do it myself.
Good for you.
And so I did.
Wow. That is awesome. We're speaking with Chris Thomas, known as Space Rogue. The book is called Space Rogue, How the Hackers Known as Loft Changed the World. And guess what? For you listeners, we're offering a special deal for the first 2 people who call in or connect and become BAI buddies. You will get an autographed copy of this book from Space Rogue himself. Rob Gila, would you tell us how people can connect and become BAI buddies? And you have to email us before 8 o'clock tonight to tell us that you did that. If you do it after 8 o'clock, it's not going to count. Not for this, anyway. It'll count for the radio station. But to get these 2 books, you got to do that now.
Well, certainly. How you do that is you go to give2wbai.org. That's give, the numeral 2, wbai.org. And there is the there are all sorts of ways you can support the station on there. One of those ways is by becoming a BAI buddy. And that is when you sign up to make a donation on a regular basis. Month to month, you become sort of a continuing donor. You become something that's amazing in the nonprofit sector, which is a dependable source of income. And you become one of the things that is really vital in keeping the station going. WBAI has been going for 63 years now, just doing this, asking people to support directly. We are not selling ads. We are not selling data. We are not selling your ears to anyone. Because, frankly, we enjoy your ears and we want to keep them all to ourselves. And the way we do that is by getting your support. So if you go to give2wbai.org and click the link that says click here to become a buddy, you will it will take you through the steps.
Now,
and after you've done that...
You won't see any mention of the book there, so don't look for that.
No.
And you can pledge any amount. We're just asking the first two people to contact us, oth@2600.com is our email address. Let us know you did that, and you'll be the first two people that get the books.
Send us a screenshot of your completed BAI Buddy transaction, or send us an email confirmation that you get. You have 25 minutes to get in on this. Email us at oth@2600.com with confirmation that you have indeed become a BAI buddy in the name of Off the Hook.
And if you can't figure out how to make a screenshot, email us and say you're working on it. As long as you get that email before 8 o'clock, then we'll count you as one of the two people that gets one of these special autographed books from Space Rogue himself.
Don't forget your snail mail address, so I know where to send the book.
Yes. Well, we're going to make sure you get all that information. We'll do a lot of handholding. Again, that's any pledge, become a BAI buddy, give to WBAI.org, and help support the radio station. If you're not one of the first two people, it's not the worst thing in the world. You can still get all kinds of other premiums from that website, regardless of whether you get the book or not. And remember, there's no mention of the book on the website, so please don't be confused when you don't see that. If you're one of the first two people to email us before 8 o'clock and say that you pledged in that way, you will be one of the two people to get the books. Simple as that. Go ahead.
And don't forget, if you're already a BAI buddy in the name of Off the Hook, we appreciate you very much. You're just not eligible for this particular promotion, but know that we love and appreciate you.
Well, hang on. They could go Space Rogue's route and make a fake name. All right, and just say that they're pledging under that name. As long as a real credit card.
Can one person be two buddies? I don't know. We can find out together.
Course.
If you've got two credit cards that get charged monthly, 100%. But yes, we just two new BAI buddies. You have 23 minutes, kids. Hop on this. This is an amazing opportunity.
I had a question. What were some of the fall-on impacts and things that happened as the Loft had sort of this renown after the hearing, of course, and then progressed as a space, and people went on to do different projects. How was their impact felt, and what kinds of reaction did the group continue to get and influence, might you say?
I'm not sure that we really felt an impact right away. I mean, yeah, everybody was surprised. Oh, wow, Loft was at Congress, you know, and we got into some press. But after a little while, it seemed that all sort of died down and went back to normal for us. We just kind of went back to hacking things and publishing things and went back to our day jobs. And we didn't, like, become overnight rich or anything and suddenly retire to Miami or something. So it didn't seem like that much changed immediately. And maybe it did, and it was just the subtle ways that we didn't realize. And I think, but now looking back, you know, it was kind of a watershed moment. And it is a moment that is, you know, one of those time marks in history. It's like pre-Loft testimony and then after-Loft testimony. And for Loft, like, we just kind of kept on doing what our thing was. We kept hacking things and publishing things and trying to make Loft pay for itself, which was our initial goal. We just wanted it to earn enough money so we could quit our jobs. And then 2000, the Y2K bug came along, and the dot-com boom came along kind of at the same time. And we're looking around, seeing all our friends getting rich off VC money. And we're like, we're still sitting here trying to barely pay the internet bill. And we're like, you know, be nice to get a piece of that. So we started, went out and started looking for some venture capital and ended up forming At Stake.
Yeah, tell us about the At Stake days, because that pretty much was how Loft finished, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That was how Loft finished. There was a venture capital company that had an internet security company that they had already founded called At Stake. Had a handful of employees and was trying to make a go of it. And Mudge was shopping us around to some of the VC, and this particular venture capital was like, you know, we already got a company, but maybe we can buy you and merge you into together and make one big company. And we're like, you know, it sounds like a good idea. And we sort of knew that Loft had reached a point where if we had kept on doing what we were doing, we would eventually get to our goal slowly, but it would have been slow and painful, mm-hmm. and a lot of road bumps along the road along the way. And now here is sort of an instant out. Just add water and boom, we're where we want to be. We've got the credibility, we got more people. We're able to hack on stuff all day. And so we're like, yeah, let's do this. And it's kind of what we wanted to do, what we were looking for anyway. But of course, you know, as what happens with a lot of good things, once you add money, it becomes a bad thing. Shortly after At Stake and Loft kind of merged, or At Stake bought Loft technically, the venture capital were like, you know, we kind of want our money back. That's kind of why we invested in you in the first place. And so they put some management in place. They brought in a CEO, they got a CFO and whatnot, and they started making some rather big changes. One of those changes was to get rid of me in the Hacker News Network. And so I had to exit stage left, and then two years later, they sold what was left to Symantec. And then Symantec kind of shut everything down, and that was the end of everything.
Why did they come after you right away?
Well, I go into this in the book. I think that there was the CEO and the management that was brought in needed to make an example of the rank and file, that nobody was protected. I just happened to be the one person that they really didn't know what to do with. The Hacker News Network, they weren't interested in at the time, which was a website that I had created that was getting some moderate traffic, but they didn't really know what to do with it as a consulting company. It didn't fit their business model. They weren't really interested. They were going to close it down. They were probably worried about what I would say when they did. So they're like, you know, we'll just get rid of Space Rogue and his HNN. And so they fired me, and they fired one other person in the Virginia office or at the same time, the Research Triangle Park, which is in North Carolina. I don't remember.
Wow.
I don't know. It's Virginia, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they fired me and one other person in the other office sort of as a token, I think, to say, okay, not everybody's untouchable. Like, there's nobody untouchable. And I think that was kind of why I was let go. It was a big shock to me.
Did you guys still have the space, the Loft space?
No. The lease had gotten up a few months earlier. And so it had been closed down and cleaned out and weren't using it anymore at all. I think I went there. The day I got fired, of course, by the time I got home, my Loft email was turned off, which is shocking because I wasn't expecting my Loft email to get turned off. I was expecting my At Stake email to go away, of course, but not my Loft email that I had for 7 years. And so I lost all that mail spool, all that history was gone. So when it came time to write the book, I wasn't able to refer to that, which was kind of a pain, made it difficult. But the Loft space itself, the lease had been up, and we had moved most of the stuff out of there into the At Stake office. And so there wasn't really anything there to go back to.
Wow. That's a sad ending as far as the way especially losing your mail. You would think that, you know, a hacker space, that would never happen to. But when corporations get involved, I guess anything's possible. Wow. Had no idea.
Don't know if you remember. You had another show about At Stake with fiber optic.
I do remember that. In fact, if I can recall, he had tried to get a job there.
Yep.
And they rejected him because he had been arrested for being a hacker.
Because he was a hacker.
Which was the ultimate irony and something that started as the Loft.
Yeah, right?
Basically rejecting somebody for being a hacker.
Yeah,
so that definitely was something. being the first one out, were there others who left afterwards? Were you able to stay on good terms with the original members?
So At Stake had also hired not a hacker type, but a luminary in cybersecurity even then, Dan Geer. And Dan ended up co-authoring a paper on homogeneous networks, basically Windows networks, and saying that such networks were not a good idea and not very secure. And he was pretty much let go shortly thereafter. They didn't say it was for his writing of the paper, but I'm fairly positive it was. But that's more Dan's story to tell than mine. But, yeah, so there were some other – and then there was the fiber optic incident. Management, I think, didn't really understand what Loft was or what we did or what we stood for or any of that, unfortunately. So, like I said, when you add money to things, it often goes bad.
Sorry, just wanted to jump in for a second. And speaking of a good way to add money to things that will not go bad, we do want to thank our first recipient of a signed copy of Space Rogue's book. One left, 15 minutes to go. Just know that there's one more, so if you're going to do it quick.
Yes, you have to email us before 8 o'clock. You can pledge after that, and you'll be helping the station, but you won't be eligible for this particular offer. So anyone who pledges as a BAI buddy will get an autographed paperback copy of Space Rogue's book. Go ahead, Rob.
Yes, and if you are one of the first two people, this person or the next one, to get your info to us about your new BAI buddyship, we will be in touch with you about getting your mailing info and all that good stuff. So if you hear from us, you're lucky.
And we thank you. And we encourage lots of people to become BAI buddies, even if, you know, you're not able to get a book tonight.
Now, we've mentioned Hacker News Network. And, can you tell us something about how that got started, what it was all about, did it relaunch?
Yeah, so Hacker News Network was an idea I had years ago of trying to basically earn some money for the Loft to pay our rent and our electric bill. We had this, you know, loft.com was probably one of the first 10,000 websites on the Internet. So it was a very early website. And it's where we published all our advisories and all our other information, and it became very, very popular. And back in the day, we call them hits, right? A lot of web hits on that site. But we didn't want to put web ads on the site. Web ads were huge. A lot of people were making a lot of money on banner ads from their websites. But we didn't want to be beholden to advertisers or have them influence anything that we'd say. So we didn't want to put ads on loft.com. But at the same time, I'm like looking at all these other websites with tons of banner ads making tons of money, and I'm like, you know, there's got to be a way that we can get a small slice of that. So I came up with this idea to create an entirely new website called Hacker News Network, and I was just going to put links on it of news stories related to hackers, right? And that's what I did. And after about a year or two, it got to be pretty popular. I'd wake up every morning, I'd scour my list of bookmarks for relevant news stories. Mm-hmm. I'd write a small blurb for each one, and I'd post it, try to have it posted up by 9 a.m. Eastern every day. So I was waking up early in the morning, gathering the news, posting it online, and it came to be a pretty good de facto source for, you know, hacker-related news.
Yeah, we use it all the time for the radio show. We always use it.
Oh, nice. That's great.
I'm sorry if we never gave credit, but we did use it.
Well, you're not the only ones. If you watch, there's a video out of from the FBI about Solar Sunrise, which was a mission that the FBI did years ago about hacking and whatnot. And in the background, on several of the shots in that video, there's the Hacker News Network on the computer monitor. So that was this thing too. But then, As Stake happened, and the venture capital didn't want Hacker News Network, and after they fired me, they kind of killed the website pretty quickly.
Wow.
And so, like, 15 years later, 10 years later, Tan, one of the Loft guys, calls me up out of the blue, and he's like, "Dude," I'm like, "What?" And he's like, "We gotta bring H&N back." I'm like, "No, we don't." He's like, yeah, we'll do it as video. I'm like, I don't know nothing about video. Me neither. And so somehow he convinced me. I borrowed a camera from my job, and I filmed the pilot episode, and I was like, yeah, I get right back into this. So we brought it back for a couple of years as video. I did a weekly news show of Hacker News Network of me in front of the camera reading the news, and we had a bunch of different segments in the show. But it was like a half hour long. So I couldn't really upload it to YouTube because at the time YouTube had a 10-minute limit.
That's right.
You remember that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we were kind of like ahead of the time, ahead of the curve, as it were. I think if I had held on for like another 6 months or so and waited for YouTube to get rid of their 10-minute limit, you know, the sky would have been the limit. But as it was, I was putting 40 hours a week into doing the H&N video show and then still trying to work 40 hours a week at my regular job. And so after 2 years of that, it was just, it was too much, and I couldn't keep it up anymore. I was burnt out, so I shut it down. And that was the end of the second incarnation of Hacker News Network.
Wow.
Had a really fun vibe to it, though. I loved the production design of it and the sunglasses everywhere. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, so the show had a Max Headroom motif, and all that was basically thanks to Tan. I would film the show in front of a green screen, and I would write the whole copy, and I would read the copy for the show, and I would upload my green screen video, and he would edit it and put the backgrounds in and the sound effects and the logos and all that funny stuff. So big thanks to Tan for that.
Spacewalk, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
That was quick.
I hope you can stick around for overtime.
I can stick around for a little while. Sure.
Okay, that'd be great. So the conversation will continue on Channel 2600 on YouTube at 8 o'clock for anybody who wants to maybe even call in as well. And for those of you who are still looking for an autographed copy of Space Rogue's book, Space Rogue, How the Hackers Known as Loft Changed the World. Actually, Chris Thomas is the author's name. Space Rogue is the handle. Please go to give2wbai.org and become a BAI buddy and email us at oth@2600.com by 8 o'clock. And if it's a tie, you know what? We'll pitch in and donate and get an extra book so people don't do that and not get a book. But for those of you who are listening in the future or don't want to do it that way, the book is available on Amazon, everywhere else. Are there other places?
Everywhere else.
Okay. Wherever you get your books.
There you go.
And it's really such a great thing. I really look forward to reading the rest of it myself. We'll be continuing the conversation over on YouTube.
Excellent. Before we go, I just want to say a quick couple of words. The hacker community, very sadly, has just had to say goodbye to a luminary among their ranks. Kelly Lum, who is known as Aloria, passed away due to complications from an illness. And she was known by so many in this community. She was a regular presence at conferences and everything, and basically nobody has a negative thing to say about her. She was a wonderful person, very welcoming, very helpful. And we're going to close with a piece of music that she once tweeted about enjoying while complaining that she had terrible taste in music. So, yes, Aloria will be missed.
Thank you, Rob. We'll see you in 2 weeks, oth@2600.com and on YouTube at 8 o'clock, Channel 2600.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York,